The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I'd like to continue talking about, I've been talking for most of the last times that I've been here, the last few weeks I've been here, I've been talking about some of the difficulties, the difficult states of mind that make it hard for us to be mindful, that make it hard for us to meditate, that make it hard for us to be present in our daily lives. And there's a standard list of what are typically called the hindrances that include sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. And over the last few weeks, I've talked about the first four, so tonight I'd really like to focus on doubt. As we engage in a practice, as we engage in meditation practice, we often find that it's not so easy. It's easy to describe what meditation is, but it's not so easy to do. And this can lead to doubt. One of the main ways that we experience doubt is, I must be doing it wrong. That's probably one of the fundamental ways that we experience doubt. We find ourselves feeling pain. We find ourselves finding ourselves caught in a lot of difficult mind states and anger, frustration, and we think, what am I doing? You know, I didn't sign up for this meditation just to feel pain in the body and to feel angry all the time. So I must be doing something wrong if I'm feeling these things. So we wonder if we are doing it right, or if perhaps this is the right practice for us. Maybe the Buddhist teachings are not relevant in this day and age. So we can have a lot of different ways that this experience of doubt comes up. And I'll just point to a few of them. One is in the teachings of the Buddha themselves. The teachings themselves, you know, as I just mentioned, you know, we think about the fact that the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, and how can it possibly be relevant to our lives in this day and age? I mean, things moved much slower then. It probably was a lot easier to be mindful then, so maybe it's just not applicable anymore. Or we have doubts about the teachers. We doubt that the teachers know what they're talking about. We think that our enlightenment or our progress in meditation depends on our teacher. You know, we know somebody who's had a really good experience with this particular teacher, and, you know, that teacher, you know, like, for instance, Jack Kornfield, you know, he doesn't work with people individually too much anymore. So, well, my chance is gone. I'll never get it to have an interview with that teacher. And so, well, it's just not going to happen for me. So we think that our practice is dependent on some particular teacher. We have doubts about the practice itself, being told to be mindful of our breathing, to be mindful of hearing. You know, what good does it do to hear the motorcycles drive up and down? What's the benefit of that? And we have doubts about ourselves, even if we have a sense that what the Buddha taught was valuable, that we do believe it's valuable to hear the motorcycle going by. We doubt that we can actually do it. We find our mind continually wandering off, and we think, well, my mind just isn't set up for this. You know, obviously, I can't do this. I had that happen to me When I first met mindfulness, when I was in my early 20s, I read the book, The Miracle of Mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh. And I thought, wow, this sounds great. I'm going to go and be mindful at work all day long. Sounded really interesting to explore things in that way. The next time I remembered about mindfulness was when I picked up the book the next night. And after a few days of that happening, I basically said, well, obviously I can't do this, and put the book aside and put mindfulness aside for 15 years. So it took me another 15 years to meet mindfulness, to get past that doubt, which is basically what it was. It was doubt. It also didn't help that I didn't have a teacher at that time. But we really doubt ourselves. We doubt whether we can do this. We find that our mind is wandering off, and, well, the teachers say that's what happened, but I know that they're just, you know, that's not what's really supposed to happen. I'm supposed to be able to get really calm and concentrated and feel really good, and all the pain's supposed to go away. And that's not happening. So clearly, I can't do this. And even if we are engaged in the practice, even if we are practicing and connecting with our experience in mindfulness and in meditation, we sometimes find that being here in California, we hear so many different teachings that we wonder what the practice we should do is. You know, we paid attention to a few breaths and then think, oh, maybe I'll try loving kindness for a while. But then we get frustrated and we think, but then I need to do something else. I need to bring in some other practice. Maybe I should try Dzogchen practice instead of this Vipassana practice from Burma. They know much more in Tibet. So we kind of pick up different practices and never really settle anywhere. And we can get hamstrung by thinking, oh, I should do this. Oh, I should do that. Maybe I should do that. And what we're doing is thinking about what we should be doing instead of actually doing something. And that's actually the way doubt really manifests. Sometimes doubt is compared to being lost in a desert. You just envision being in a desert where there's no or not much in the way of signposts. You know, if you're lost, what you might end up doing is taking a few steps in one direction and thinking, oh, that's not the right way to go, and then going back, and then maybe a few steps in another direction, and just continually second-guessing ourselves rather than committing to a direction and going. So doubt often manifests as a wavering, a sense of not being able to commit. It also manifests as a lack of clarity at times. I've been offering each week that I've talked about these difficult states of mind an analogy. There's an analogy for each of the hindrances around reflecting how clear seeing is kind of analogous with being able to see ourselves reflected in a bowl of water. And we can see that reflection in the bowl of water when the water is still and it's not got anything growing in it and it's not got any stuff in the water. Each of the hindrances, and I'll just mention these now. So sense desire is compared to as if there were dye in that bowl of water. And ill will is as if that bowl of water is boiling. And sloth and torpor is as if there's algae growing on the surface of the water. Restlessness is as if a wind is blowing across the surface of the water. And doubt is compared to the water being really muddy and stirred up, kind of this muddy throughout the water. So in each of these analogies, there's an aspect of the metaphor that the eye can see clearly, but there are obscurations that the eye can see, but there are obscurations that prevent us from seeing clearly. The reflection is not clear because of the things that are growing in the water, or the ripples on the water, or the boiling water, or the mud in the water. So the reflection is not clear. So the hindrances tend to alter our perception. They alter the way we see, so we're not seeing clearly. This is kind of the way that this analogy works. So the muddy water is, you know, stirred up, it's unclear, it's cloudy, so there's not clarity in the mind when there is doubt in the mind. One of the kind of hallmarks of doubt, there's often a lot of thinking going on in the mind when there's doubt going on. Very often it's kind of a spinning of thoughts in the mind. And I've mentioned some of the ways that this can happen, you know, thoughts such as, I can't do this, this practice doesn't work, this practice won't work for me, how does this apply to me today? You know, those kinds of thoughts. What is interesting about this kind of thought is that it can sound to our minds really wise, as if we are actually seeing very clearly and being very rational about things. Well, obviously I can't do this. This is just clear that I can't do this. Or, you know, thinking about the way life was at the time of the Buddha. You know, things were very slow back then, much more spacious lifestyle. You know, if I had that kind of a spacious lifestyle, it would be much easier to bring mindfulness into my day. But we don't actually know what life was like back then, but we think it might have been slower, easier. So the thoughts of doubt can sometimes fool us into thinking that they are thoughts of wisdom. So it's helpful to get familiar with the kinds of thoughts that reflect doubt in your own mind. I'm sure you know some of those thoughts in your own mind. What are the thoughts that let you know doubt is happening? If you can recognize that the thoughts are doubt, you have a chance. While you are caught in doubt, basically, doubt stops our practice. It stops our mindfulness because we believe these thoughts, as it did for me. It stopped that possibility for 15 years. So if you can recognize, if you experience doubt and you believe it, your practice has come to a halt in a way. If mindfulness becomes present and you can recognize that the thoughts that are occurring, and at some point in the thoughts occurring, mindfulness will arise. Mindfulness is not something that happens just because we practice meditation. It actually is a natural, very natural, ordinary quality of mind that happens to us. It actually happens to us all the time, but we just don't notice it, and we don't really think it's a valuable quality to cultivate until somebody points it out and says, hey, pay attention to this. This is really helpful. So at some point in the mind spinning in doubt, a moment of mindfulness will appear. And if you can recognize that that moment of mindfulness has appeared, and you can check in and say, oh, this is doubt, then you have an opportunity to kind of break that cycle of the spinning in doubt. So the most important thing in terms of working with doubt is to learn to recognize it. Get familiar with it. Get familiar with the stories that you tell yourself around doubt. We each, I think, have our own favorite flavors of doubt. Many of us, I think, it is self-doubt. For many, many of us, self-doubt. In my exploration of doubt, I found, for myself at least, that there are different ways that seem to me helpful in terms of approaching it, depending on the kind of doubt there is. Sometimes the doubt can seem kind of intellectual. You know, we're thinking about the teachings, we're thinking about the practice, we're thinking about what the Buddha taught. So we're thinking in our minds about the practice. And that's actually a good way to recognize that you're caught in doubt. If you find yourself thinking about the practice rather than engaging in the practice, there may be doubt happening. So sometimes this doubt is intellectual. We are caught into an intellectual spin trying to figure out, you know, whether this thing will work and how it will work before we engage. You know, we kind of want to convince ourselves that this is worth engaging in. So we think about how it's going to work. We think about how it might help us, as opposed to actually starting the practice. So when it's intellectual like that, one thing I've found helpful is to reflect that one of the things that the Buddha often offered was, you don't have to believe this. Try it and see what happens. The willingness to try, even if you don't have all the evidence marshaled that it's going to make your life better, or whatever you think the meditation is going to do for you. Just the willingness to try it. I often think about this in terms of like being a scientist, you know? The only way you're going to know if something works or not is to run the experiment. Thinking about it doesn't let you know if it's going to work. It is something that needs to be engaged with. It is a practice that needs to be tried. So run the experiment. Try it and see. That one has helped me when I found myself spinning, thinking, what should I do? How should I do it? You know, even if it's the kind of thing where I'm trying to choose between different practices, it's kind of like, just pick one and see what happens. Just try it. We learn how something works. We learn whether something is supportive. We learn how to engage by being willing to engage. So just that willingness. Just willingness to try it. So when doubt has kind of got that intellectual quality, it can be helpful to just suspend the disbelief and give it a try. Sometimes doubt actually is covering up some other emotion. That there's doubt on the surface, it seems like there's doubt happening. But when you actually explore a little bit, you find that there's some other emotion underneath. So I've got a couple of examples of this from my own practice. Both are from retreat. And one, it was one of my early retreats. I think it was my second longish retreat. And I found myself experiencing what seemed to be doubt You know, I kept thinking about things and trying to figure things out. And so I decided one morning I would ask the question about doubt, how to work with doubt in the hall. And as I tried to phrase the question to myself, you know, tried to reflect on how would I express this question, I took some time thinking about that. The beginning, the first two words of every sentence that I came up with to say were, "I'm afraid." And when I realized that, I thought, wow, maybe this isn't about doubt. Maybe this is about fear. And so I began exploring that. I actually never got to ask my question. I didn't get called on. But I began exploring fear in my practice, and it was everywhere. I was walking, doing walking meditation, and I saw somebody coming from the distance, and I'd feel fear. It was all over the place. I mean, it wasn't like terror or anything. It was just, I was easily startled and having a sense of, I'm not safe a lot of the time. When I noticed that, the doubt went away. I was no longer working with doubt, but I was working with what seemed to be a deeper layer. Somehow, the fear had been masked by this veneer of thinking of, well, this practice isn't going to work for me, or, you know, that kind of thing. I can't even remember what the doubting thoughts were at this point, but it was very interesting to me to recognize in the trying to frame the question about doubt, I was actually listening and being mindful of the thoughts, and I heard that fear was underneath. On another long retreat, this one came later in my practice after I had started doing actually quite long retreats, month-long or 3-month-long retreats, and I had kind of decided to let go of my job to allow myself to spend more time on long retreats. So I was taking a couple of years off from work so I could really focus on the practice. And what was coming up was doubt about whether I should be sitting so many long retreats. And this was coming up really strongly in a walking meditation. And I noticed, again, it's thoughts. It was coming up as thoughts. I'd be doing walking and I'd find myself lost in thought, thinking about whether or not I should be doing long retreats. On a long retreat, what I was doing with my walking. When I finally recognized this was happening, it took a little while before I actually recognized, okay, there's something going on here. What I did was I vowed that I would stop as soon as I noticed myself thinking and take note of whatever that experience, that thought was. And what happened was that it seemed like each time I stopped, I noticed like a layer slightly below that doubt about whether I should be sitting so many long retreats. The first layer was doubt whether I was good enough to be doing all this long-term practice, kind of like fear that I'm not measuring up somehow, kind of a sense that I'm not good enough. Then underneath that, or the next thought that I exposed, was a kind of a feeling of unworthiness to have left my job to do this practice. And underneath that was insecurity about my financial situation. And underneath that was aversion to this insecurity. I mean, I remember that thought really clearly. It was like, this is not acceptable. And underneath that was vulnerability. And when I finally touched into vulnerability, it's like, oh, vulnerability. This is actually a truth. This is true that we're vulnerable. And when I could touch into that vulnerability, kind of that cascading, those cascading layers on top of that, which led to myself thinking about shouldn't be doing so many long retreats or doubt that I should be doing so many long retreats, It came down to this feeling of vulnerability. And when I just hung out with that feeling of vulnerability, I could actually hang out with that feeling of vulnerability. So sometimes if you turn towards doubt, you'll find, in this case, you know, many layers of things layered on top of each other. Different emotional reactions. Sometimes you may find that. If you can find what's underneath the doubt, an emotion that is kind of fueling the doubt, if you can turn to that feeling itself, turn to the feeling of vulnerability, of inadequacy, of insecurity. These kinds of emotions actually, I think, often underlie self-doubt. Feelings of vulnerability, inadequacy, fear of failure. If you can connect with those feelings, the doubt doesn't have any place to enter. And actually, I find when I actually find out what's underneath, it seems much easier to actually connect with that than it is to have the mind torn apart by doubt. To be feeling like you're lost in that desert. As soon as you connect with experience, doubt has no chance. That's one of the great understandings that we can have around our meditation practice, that the antidote to doubt is sustaining the attention on some experience. It can be anything. So even if you can't connect with the emotional experience underneath, if you can connect with your feet on the ground for a few moments, there's no room for the doubt to enter. If you can be mindful of something for a few moments, doubt can't come in. So that's a great way, it's a great tool in our tool chest for working with doubt. Just pick something. When you can recognize that it's doubt, that's the big trick here. Is recognizing that doubt is happening. Another thing that can lead us to doubt or to feel strange in our meditation practice is connecting or fear of the unknown, fear of what we don't understand. Sometimes in our meditation we meet very odd experiences and we think, this can't be right. You know, even when the meditation is going along, you know, it's like, what is this? It feels like I can't be mindful. Obviously I'm doing something wrong. Certain times in the practice, experience gets kind of strange. Whatever you are experiencing is not a problem. The key here is to notice your relationship to what you're experiencing. Feeling like I'm experiencing this thing and I'm afraid of the unknown, or I'm experiencing this thing and I feel like this can't be right. That's what we need to recognize, this feeling. This can't be right. We feel, or we are experiencing some experience of things changing so rapidly, and we feel fear about that. There's nothing that we cannot meet with our mindfulness, but certain experiences come along that feel kind of strange. The path is always towards just meeting whatever's happening and noticing how you're relating to it. Those two pieces are really key. If we're just trying, for instance, if fears are rising, I mean, if we're seeing things change really rapidly and fears are rising, and we think, okay, what I'm supposed to do is to be with things changing really rapidly, we're missing the fact that fear is happening. Fear is really what needs to be paid attention to. The relationship to what's happening is key. When things start to feel odd in our practice, if you feel like, I don't know what I'm doing, see if you can check into how you're relating to your experience. Is there some attitude you're bringing to the meditation that has not been really noticed? And that is the pathway all the way through the practice. Notice your experience, notice your relationship to it. It doesn't matter what your experience is, even if it feels like your meditation is falling apart. So really the key to doubt, first, to recognize it. Second, to be willing to practice with it. To be willing to turn towards it. To explore, what is this doubt? You could ask it a question even. You know, what purpose are you serving? What purpose are you serving? Sometimes that can get underneath. Now that question, I want to take care in putting that question into your meditation. I mean, essentially what's happening in doubt is there's a lot of thoughts going on. And sometimes, you know, you can insert a thought into that stream of thoughts. But the idea then isn't to think about it. It's kind of like to let that thought drop into the space of your mind and then notice what happens. So what kind of purpose is this serving? If you kind of drop that question into your mind, you may at that point, it doesn't always produce any kind of a result, but sometimes It seems to orient the whole sphere of our experience around that question almost automatically without our having to do anything. And suddenly there's an experience in our being that helps us to understand what purpose this is serving. So that dropping a question in like that isn't to think about it. It's kind of like drop it in and then sit back and see what happens. What happens in your mind and your body with that question added to your meditation? The other piece that I like to call on in when there's doubt is its kind of opposite, which is confidence or faith. At first, when we meet the practice, we can't know that something is true. We have to kind of take it on faith, in a way. We can't know that turning mindfully towards our difficult emotions will actually be a way to release those difficult emotions. It sounds so counterintuitive. How can that be? And so we have to take it on faith. We have to be willing to explore, willing to try. That willingness, as I was talking about before, that willingness to run the experiment, that willingness is kind of the very smallest seeds of confidence. And engaging, as we engage and try it, usually what happens is that we begin to understand directly for ourselves how it works. We understand the benefits for ourselves. And this becomes what might be called verified confidence, verified faith. Initially, we have to borrow faith. We borrow faith from our teachers, we borrow faith from books we read, we borrow faith from our friends who've gone on retreats or done the practice. people who've said, wow, this has really helped me. Why don't you try it? We have to kind of borrow that faith for a while. But then when we engage, it becomes verified. And that verified faith, that verified confidence can serve us when we experience doubt. Reflecting back on the ways that this practice has helped us. If you find yourself caught in a storm of doubt, what good does this practice do? How can this possibly help me out in this particular situation? Reflecting back, I was just talking to somebody recently who said, you know, I do see that, you know, the things that I used to be so reactive to, I'm not nearly as reactive to those anymore. I said, let yourself consciously connect with that. Consciously recognize that you are experiencing benefits here and now. That will help to support that willingness to keep engaging. And that willingness, that confidence counters doubt. So the kind of doubt I've been talking about tonight really kind of stops our practice. We get stuck, we vacillate, we think, how does this work? Why should I do this? What practice should I do? We kind of just vacillate back and forth without ever going anywhere. And there's another kind of doubt, something that it's sometimes called doubt, or we might think of it as doubt, but it actually serves as a fuel to our practice. Kind of a sense of engagement, of curiosity, of how can I more deeply understand this? So there's a way that we can take that energy of those questions and turn that energy of doubt into the practice and let it serve as a fuel for inquiry. Inquiry to, how does this practice actually work in my life? Not by asking the question in our minds, but by actually engaging. So there's no need to let go of critical inquiry or critical thinking. There's actually a beautiful teaching on that that maybe in a couple of weeks I'll talk about. It's a teaching where the Buddha talked with people who are experiencing a lot of perplexity and doubt. And the Buddha's response was, confusion and doubt have arisen to you about a perplexing matter. It's natural for you to feel doubt in this situation. And he provided them some guidance about how to use that perplexity to engage. So I'd like to leave some time for comments or questions. If there's anything that anybody would like to offer or ask. Yeah, Irv. Could you wait for the mic?
What did you do with the feeling of vulnerability?
I just allowed it to be there. And it was interesting because that feeling of vulnerability, you know, I was on a long retreat, so the mindfulness was pretty in a pretty good momentum. And so I had the capacity to meet that vulnerability without reactivity. So I could just feel vulnerable. And in a way, that is a truth. You know, that it is a truth, that vulnerability is it underlies so much. And we do so much trying to avoid that feeling, trying to make ourselves feel secure, to make ourselves feel like we can do things and have things and engage in things. And a lot of what's fueling that is a fear of actually meeting that feeling. And what I found was that actually meeting that feeling wasn't so bad.
You were able to get down that far.
Yes.
Why didn't you go further? Maybe there's something under vulnerability.
There wasn't anything arising that was obvious under vulnerability. I mean, I stayed with it. It didn't Nothing else came at that time. I can see, yes, at some time perhaps my mindfulness might be a little stronger, it would be able to go underneath the vulnerability. But at that time, that's where the mindfulness kind of resonated, and so it just stayed there.
I ask these questions, Andrea, because many of us, including me, quite often feel invulnerable. Mm-hmm. And the best thing we can do is to feel vulnerable, which you did, and it turns out that the feeling itself, which at first is very painful, is a terrific release.
Yes.
So what I'm trying to say is, okay, it wasn't bad. It was good, not only in a sense you got that far, but the fact you gave up, I don't know if it's true for you, but the feeling of invulnerability.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, and it's true. It doesn't feel bad when you actually can meet some of these truths. It's kind of like what happens when you meet something like that is that the mind gets aligned with the truth. And that alignment, I think that's what feels like the release. You know, that's what feels like, you know, it's like we're not fighting anymore with reality. We're aligning ourselves with reality, and that, I think, is where the release comes from, because we're no longer fighting with reality. At least that's kind of my understanding. Thank you for that, Irv. Yeah. Did you pass the mic?
You said something I want to make sure that I heard correctly, understood, and remember, and I want to take with me from here. I think it was about reactivity and understanding your relationship to your reaction. Is that...
So, okay.
Maybe you did something with your arm that you know, said to me subconsciously, ooh, this is really central and important. So I would like that underscored, please.
I don't know that I'll do the same things with my arms. These things happen. So the piece I was talking about was that there's what's happening and there's our reaction to it. And so there's our relationship to experience. And those two pieces are really helpful to recognize. Often when we're being mindful, we're kind of stuck in a pattern of paying attention to kind of what is happening. You know, okay, yep, there's pressure, there's vibration, there's the sound, so we're kind of in that mode of paying attention. There's a breath, there's a feeling. And what we don't think of doing or checking into is how are we paying attention to that thing? So so it's kind of like the what and the how of our experience. So in that attention to the breath, for example, paying attention to the breath, you know, the breath might start feeling really good. And then the way we're paying attention to it is to kind of start having an agenda towards holding on to that breath because it feels so good. And if we don't notice we have that agenda, we're missing a big part of what this practice can help us with. And in the area around doubt in particular, so that's kind of just one way that can manifest. In the area around doubt, you know, some of the doubts around the practice, for instance, if you're coming into the situation where, you know, it's like suddenly you start experiencing a lot of boredom in your practice. And you feel like, well, that can't be right. I'm not supposed to be bored. So if we have the idea in our mind that... instead of just observing boredom as it is, we have some idea that we have to fix that boredom because it can't be right. And so that idea, our attitude around it is, this has to be fixed. And we need to recognize if we have that if we have some kind of an agenda. The boredom isn't actually the main thing that's happening in that situation. What's happening is that we think we have to fix it. And so it's kind of like one way to get at this is to kind of back up a little bit, because we get a little bit narrow in our attention. So we're looking at something like boredom. You know, I'm looking at boredom. I'm paying attention to boredom. But the whole way that I'm paying attention to it is with the idea or agenda of fixing it. And so if you can back up a bit and say, and what else is going on here? Or what's my relationship to boredom? Don't think it should be happening. Trying to fix it. When we can allow that to come into our awareness, it kind of releases the sticky glue in a way that is keeping that pattern in place. So it's like, you know, when we have some kind of an agenda, this has got to be fixed. It almost locks that thing into place in a way, in a funny way. You know, it seems to be the way our minds work. And so we need to kind of back up so that we can notice what our relationship to our experience is. And again, you can ask yourself that question. You can use a question in your meditation. And I don't recommend doing this all the time. I mean, if you're sitting there going, okay, and what's my relationship? And what's my relationship? And what's my... You're just going to go nuts. But, you know, 2 or 3 times, 4 times during a sitting, checking in. What's my relationship to my experience? Or what's my relationship to the meditation as a whole? That's even a slightly different question. There's the thing that's happening and the way we pay attention to it. And then there's the whole process of meditation and what our agendas and plans and expectations and ideas around that are. All of these things, if they are not made conscious, they are running the show. They're the thing that's kind of driving what is going on outside of our awareness. And so partly all it takes is just bringing them into consciousness. We don't actually have to do too much except notice, oh, okay, there is also this agenda. This agenda is operating. And allow yourself to take in the fact that that is also present in your mind. It's really, really helpful. So thank you. Is this doubt? Or clarity? Okay.
So now I'm afraid you've filled me with doubt. I was just wondering, I think I've heard this before, and you mentioned it now, this thing about, I almost feel like when you're a beginner, you know, you pay attention to the breath, and that's kind of all that you're really supposed to be doing, is just paying attention to the breath. But it sounds like there's something that once you kind of get in that mode where you're kind of in that paying attention to the breath, it's almost like you could be doing it wrong, or there's something else that you should start to do. So I was wondering if you could speak to that, or I mean, maybe that still paying attention to the breath is good, but it could be better if you started to do this. Or...
Well, I mean, I think, you know, paying attention to the breath is helpful. It's really helpful. It helps to stabilize the mind. In the practice that we teach here, we teach that as a grounding to begin the practice. Once the mind is quieted down a little bit, then you can start opening up to allow other experience. And I did that in the guided meditation some, you know, the hearing, other body sensation can come in. And it's not, we don't have to hold to the breath. We don't have to hold too tightly to the breath. It can be, at times, it can be very skillful to choose to stay with the breath for the purposes of developing concentration. And the breath can take you all the way. I mean, according to the Buddha, you can do mindfulness of breathing and get enlightened. You don't have to do anything else. So it's not necessary to pay attention to other experience, except that when the Buddha talked about mindfulness of breathing, it wasn't restricted to just the breathing. It's also paying attention to how the mind relates to the experience of breathing. So keeping in mind that in the meditation, you know, if you're paying attention to the experience of breathing, from time to time it might be helpful to check in. How am I paying attention to this breathing? Am I holding on tight to the breathing, trying to not let my mind wander? Maybe I could back off a little bit. Maybe the mind could be a little more relaxed around paying attention to the breathing. Or am I bored with the breathing? Am I just staying here kind of with, as an act of will? So there are some things that we can expose in how we're engaging with the breath that are helpful so that we can create a kind of a container for the practice that has more ease and relaxation. Essentially, what we're trying to go for in the meditation is ability to be relaxed and attentive to our experience. If we choose to attend to the breath, that's fine. If we choose to open up to wider experience, that's fine. But this kind of relaxed attentiveness is key. And sometimes as we're just staying on the breath, staying on the breath, staying on the breath, we're actually missing that we're kind of tight and tense around it rather than relaxed and at ease around it. So it's fine to stay with the breath for a very long time, but do check in about how you are doing that. Is it an easeful attention?
You have released my doubt.
And it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention. I'll see you next week.